This season of the Future Great City podcast is sponsored by Red Brick Realty, a new full-service boutique brokerage firm focused on helping you buy and sell residential, commercial, and investment properties. Tell Red Brick you heard about them here on the Future Great City podcast, and you'll receive $500 off buying or selling a home, apartment building, or commercial property. You can reach Scott Sturdivant at 314-420-9491 or Scott at redbrickstl.com. This is the Future Great City podcast from nextstl.com. We are joined by John Schneider, who's a, something of a guru of light rail, streetcars, and transportation in Cincinnati. And so we're going to get a perspective on kind of the coming of the streetcar to Cincinnati, which is actually up and running but not open to the public yet, and the long road it took to get there. And we'll talk a little bit about St. Louis and Metrolink and John's experience with that. But welcome to the podcast, John.
No, great. Welcome to Cincinnati.
Yeah, thanks. So I, as a lot of people know, I think, that listen to this, my wife is from here. I spend a little bit of time here. So I've been paying attention to the news stories about the streetcar, but give us a quick kind of where it stands. Like where, and we'll get back to the history, but what's happening right now with the Cincinnati streetcar?
Right now, all the drivers have been hired. I think all the mechanics have been hired. The drivers have in their required training. They are now going through their 50,000 line checklist, crossing off items that are going to have to be checked out before the Federal Transit Administration will let them open. But you see the streetcars out on the streets all the time now, you know, running. They're running what's called simulated service. They just can't pick up passengers. My understanding is the cars are performing beautifully. We now own them. Cincinnati's accepted them from the manufacturer, and they're very pleased. We used a Spanish vehicle, CAF. I can't tell you the Spanish name. Produces New York subway cars, Amtrak cars, a big international company. We were the North American launch customer for that vehicle. Kansas City actually piggybacked on our order. They got open before us because we had some politics that kind of got in the way, as you may know.
Yeah, that'll be fun to get to. But so we're recording actually on the top of the 21C Hotel downtown.
Yes.
Here in Cincinnati. So we may hear the streetcar go by. Is that right?
We're
on the route.
It comes by here at this time of day about every 12 minutes. Yep. And it's a crowd pleaser. People will stop and gawk at it and right. Turn their phones on.
And so far, Kansas City, you know, we're on the other side of Missouri in St. Louis, but we've been following that, and ridership there has kind of been off the charts. I mean, it's been a huge success.
6,300 people a day. It's the right. most passengers per mile of any of these modern streetcar systems anywhere in the country, including Portland.
And you have a similar system here, right? So we're building a streetcar in St. Louis, but it's not a modern streetcar, and it's really not in the Central Business District, and it's not the same type of thing that Kansas City did and that Cincinnati's doing. But what you're doing here is similar to Kansas City, correct?
Yeah, very similar. From what I can tell, the pictures of the route, very similar. I think their streets are wider than ours. Most Western streets are wider than Eastern cities. It's funny, there are streets like Main Street and 12th Street that I see names of stops. We have those same stops here in Cincinnati. The pattern does seem to sort of hold. They've kind of broken new ground. Of course, they have free fares, and that makes a big difference on the ridership. Our fares are going to be $1 for 2 hours or $2 for a day pass.
That's pretty cheap.
It's pretty low. It's pretty low, yeah. But it's nothing like free.
You know? Right. So let's, and we'll go even further back at some point because you've been involved in a lot of things here in Cincinnati. But let's go back to the beginning, at least, you know, 5-6 years ago for the streetcar. So how did you guys get to this point? And how was the money found? And how were the politics resolved? And how did you get to the point where you could put a streetcar on, you said, some narrow streets and in the middle of your downtown?
Well, let's go back to, you know, we started planning light rail basically with a lot of advice from Tom Shrout there in St. Louis in the 90s. We had a regional vote for 60 miles of rail in 2002 that lost 2-1. But it was interesting. While it lost 2-1 in the county, we noticed it won by 2-1 in downtown Cincinnati and over the Rhine, the historic district just north of downtown. And we thought, wow, that was just a $750,000 marketing study we just held that November of 2002. And so, but it really showed us that some people really wanted rail, and there were others who didn't. So,
and the equivalent, I mean, part of the reason I like talking about Cincinnati is I have some experience here and I've been here, but it's also very analogous to St. Louis. So the city is about 300,000 people.
Yes.
The metro area is a little bit smaller than St. Louis, but you're dealing with some of the same city-county divide. And so what you're saying, the analogy in St. Louis would be St. Louis County voted it down, but the city voted overwhelmingly in favor of it. So
the city did not vote. For it. It lost in the city, too. But, you know, I think, all
but,
these...
But the central neighborhoods, I see what you're saying.
Yeah,
fair.
But all these neighborhoods, or these cities, St. Louis, Louisville, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, these sort of brick river towns, there are a lot of similarities. They have hills to a certain extent, some of them, brick buildings, historic districts, more old ports, things like that. So we're, I think, very similar to St. Louis. We've always sort of patterned ourselves after St. Louis a little bit in the rail.
Yeah, so the big regional initiative lost. But you noticed there was support, at least in the central, what you call the central corridor here, the University of Cincinnati to downtown for rail, and then you took off
from
there.
So about the time we lost so badly, Portland had rolled out its streetcar in 2001. You've seen Czech Republic-made vehicles. And so we, after our defeat then, starting in about 2003, we said, look, we're going to have to show people what we're talking about. So I got Delta Airlines to give me 30 tickets that were good anywhere in the United States for, could be canceled, could be reissued, could be turned in, that enabled me to take some influential people, highly networked people, out to Portland for several years starting in about 2003. That kind of planted the seed. Those trips then were very popular. We ended up making 35 of them. 560 people went out on those trips. So we, over the time, built up an amazing amount of people from all walks of life in Cincinnati who had lived this, had seen it, who had met with the mayor and the congressman and the Portland Trailblazers and small business people who said, this has really been great for Portland. And then we elected a new mayor in 2005, Mark Mallory, who was a big transit supporter. He started it to get behind the streetcar in about 2007. So what are we now, 9 years later? We're about ready to open. Along the way, the opponents, they exist in every city. They're particularly ferocious here. They gathered signatures to put the issue on a ballot in 2009. We beat that handily. We thought we were then home free. Of course, the Tea Party came along in 2010, which was new energy for the anti-rail movement in Cincinnati. So they put another ballot issue up in 2011. By the way, I would just say to your listeners out there, these guys were terrible drafters of ballot issues. I knew when I saw the first ballot issue.
The language of it was pretty rough.
The language was rough.
I remember hearing that it would outlaw or not allow like expansion of the zoo train or something.
Yes.
I mean, it was really like farcical.
Would not let
stuff,
right? Money be spent on rail, and the city of Cincinnati owns the Cincinnati terminal, Union Terminal over here, so we could not improve that. I mean, it was so poorly drafted. As soon as I read it, I said, we can beat this. And we did. And then they were a little better the next time. That was a flat 10-year prohibition on any type of investment in rail. And nobody thought that was wise. We won again. And then we had a mayor that ran on the platform of killing the streetcar in 2013. So we had a ballot issue in 2009, again in 2011, sort of Tea Party fueled. 2013, Mayor John Cranley ran against killing the streetcar. He won by a decisive margin, and 6 of 9 council members who were elected that time were streetcar opponents. So in November of 2013, we all of a sudden had a supermajority of council and the mayor all for killing this project.
And at this point, the project was engineered. There was federal funding for it,
under construction.
It was under construction already.
About a half mile of track had been built. The cars had been signed for, and parts were being sourced.
And it wasn't just rhetoric. They actively tried to kill the project, correct?
They stopped construction. They just ended the contracts. Thankfully, some wise people in the city, including Vice Mayor David Mann, who is a former congressman and also had a former mayor of Cincinnati, said, look, I want an audit of this. I want to know what we're going to lose if we kill this project. What would it cost to finish it versus killing it? Well, as it turned out, it cost almost as much to kill the project as it would be to just go ahead and finish it. And at that point, we'd spend $80 million, and no one wanted to say, we spent $80 million off or not. And, of course, they would have to go back. And
you have some subway tunnels here in Cincinnati that would
That's a whole other story. But that's that. And there are some parallels. In each case, the party that wanted to be in power basically said the other party are incompetent and crooks. And they used in the 30s or the 20s, I guess, the example of the subway system that was poorly managed as a way to gain power at City Hall. And then, again, the sort of progressive elements were thrown out in 2013 and a more conservative council elected. But we're here, and I told people, look, I've seen this movie before. I think I know how it ends. Just keep the faith. We're going to get this thing done. So after the council and the mayor voted to stop the project, we, in a very short amount of time, gathered I can't remember the number, I think about 10,000 signatures to place the issue on the ballot in the middle of winter. We knew we could get our supporters out.
Third ballot initiative.
This would be the third, but this is the one that we did.
Basically the fourth vote
fourth referendum on the streetcar. And we said, we're going to put this on the ballot in 2 months in February. We'll get our supporters out, and it's going to basically say you got to finish the project. Mm-hmm. We also, of the six city council members diametrically opposed the project, in that approximately, 30-day period there, we changed votes. We had six of those people, of the six who were opposed, three of them said, no, we're not going to stop this. So then we had a supermajority. We had 6 of 9 votes.
So, I mean, you really changed the conversation. Because it's easy for someone to say, hey, I'm against this thing. It's a waste. It's a boondoggle. It's X millions of dollars. But then when you actually were able to put the question to them and say, do you really want to stop this?
Right.
Do you really want to throw away what we've done and not actually complete this? You changed votes.
I think that was a big move. But also in that sort of very pregnant moment when it was going to be canceled, people started to really look seriously at the benefits of it. We never lost sight of that. We said, you know, this project is going to do a lot of good. It's going to help repopulate our city. So, and the mayor, to his credit, actually did some things to keep the project alive. The special track work, you know, there's only one or two manufacturers of that, you know, where the tracks cross and switches and stuff like that. You have to get in line to do that. To his credit, when he was trying to stop the project, he allowed that work to go forward because he realized that if we got out of line, we would not be opening on September 9th of this year. We'd be opening on, you know, sometime probably a year from now. So we regrouped. We got the council to overturn the mayor's action, to reverse themselves, and construction started again. We lost about most of a month. But we actually finished way ahead of schedule. I think 6 months ahead of schedule. The project is virtually complete. I mean, it's large sections have been toured of the city. We're still under budget. It is a real success story if you discount the politics.
Right. So let's talk about why you would do this in the first place, right? I think for a lot of people listening to this and people who visit Next STL, it's kind of like, you know, streetcars are a popular thing. We're all kind of celebrating that they're coming back to American cities. But why do you build a streetcar in Cincinnati? What's the purpose?
You know, that's a key question. And for your listeners, I think they need to hear this message. We really, from the get-go, determined what our objective was. That is, you know, a key thing. If you look around the country, when streetcar conversation comes up, it's, well, we want to promote tourism. You know, we want to, promote better transportation to some attraction. One thing that reminds the Bill Clinton Museum in Little Rock, there's a streetcar that takes people to that museum across the river there. But we said this is about repopulation. We never got off that. If you would line up all the streetcar supporters today, I think 99% of them would tell you that. And so the arguments that, well, it's kind of slow, it's like, yeah, we know. This isn't fast transportation. This is about enabling people to live downtown and spend their money downtown and not have the burden of a car.
This isn't connecting Westchester or Marymount or the West Side.
This is about redensifying the central part of our city, which frankly wants to be redensified. So we stayed with that objective, and because we were so solid on that, that helped us a lot.
Let me ask you, how is the depopulation of the city viewed in Cincinnati? So, and I'm looking at numbers where, you know, Cincinnati peaked at about 500,000 people, you know, in the mid-century, 1950.
Yeah.
And now we're at about 297,000, and that's a pretty big decrease. It's less than what happened in St. Louis, and I think St. Louis is often we're, every project is kind of burdened by this traumatic loss. I mean, we peaked at 850,000. Now we're the size of Cincinnati. And so we've gone from an incredibly dense city to huge gaps. But if you look nearer to our time, from 2000 to 2010, St. Louis lost about 8% of its population, 29,000 people. Cincinnati lost more people. Cincinnati
about
lost 10%. 10.5%. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting, and I don't hear conversations in St. Louis about repopulating the city. It's about connecting the region, and how do we get more people to drive downtown from 20 miles away? How is population loss viewed in Cincinnati? I mean, is there a mantra or people, you know, really behind repopulating the city? Is it about connecting the suburbs?
I think it's, my training's in economics, and I'm going to give you the economic answer. First of all, I think that you've got to look at a loss of population as a vote against your city. I mean, you know, it means that at the margin, some people think their needs are better met not living in the city. So, it's kind of a black mark, and you want to regain population. The key thing is, though, it was not only gaining the population, it was gaining the spending of the population. That's what really drives the economy, because if people, you know, keep their cars and it becomes very easy for them to drive to a suburban mall, that's really a loss. It's like we have like five or six Fortune 500 employers right on the streetcar line. So the city gets their taxes, their earnings taxes. But about two out of three of those people don't live in the city, so we don't get their spending. And it's spending that really drives investment and drives the development of employment and things like that. So I think repopulation is extremely important. I guess you can overdo it. Seattle's maybe doing that right now. San Francisco may be doing that right now.
Is that something that the city council talks about? Is it something the mayor's behind? Do you see it in other policies?
I think Mark Mallory, the prior mayor who retired in 2013, he was very concerned about the loss of population, particularly a lot of it happened on his watch. But I think it's out there. I think people, you know, think that's really kind of a key thing to gain residents. You know,
what's the right number? I know. So I've written a few things about how dense should St. Louis be and what would it look like. And we've examined population loss in St. Louis, and a lot of it has to do with the change in the size of families.
Sure.
And things like that. So right. You would have lost 20% of the population no matter what, if unless you had built new things. So
yeah.
Is there a right number for Cincinnati? Is there a target? Is there
let's go back to your 1950 number. We're built for a city of 500,000 people. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a great park system. We have a sewer system built for that capacity. We have, you know, we have the physical infrastructure for that. And, you know, I tell people, you know, if you know, the snow still falls on Walnut Street out here, whether there are 500,000 residents or 100,000 residents, it has to be cleaned off. You know, so I think 500,000 was when city was really rolling and going, and you know, on the cover of Life magazine's the best managed city in America, like in 1960. I mean, that's when we were really doing things. So, yeah, I think repopulation's key. I really do.
Well, let's touch on some of the other things you've done in Cincinnati. I mean, you've been, I've read that you've been described as a civic entrepreneur, and we have a few of those in St. Louis, and they're often focused on museums and parks and things like that. But you've really, taken the deep dive on transportation, on interstate restructuring. Tell us a little bit about when that started. There's something called Fort Washington Way downtown, mm-hmm. carries multiple interstates, I understand, divides the riverfront from downtown, and that was remade two decades ago, more or less. How did you get involved in that? Why did you
think
you're
I'm a real estate developer, and so I understand, the built world. So I just look at physical conditions and think, is this as good as it could be? My first, I was tapped to the board of Downtown Cincinnati Incorporated with all the bank presidents and corporate presidents of the city because they had to round up a bus rider and a downtown resident, and I was one of the few that met that qualification. But I became chairman of this transportation committee, and part of the agenda was to build rail, and an idea I had was to our very wide Fort Washington Way, which is Interstate 71 and US 50, was consuming a huge part of our riverfront, not unlike St. Louis, okay? And my idea was, let's reconfigure that, let's get rid of a lot of the exits, put in service roads, let's design it for as a modern freeway. And we reduced that to half its current size, which then provided the land for the big riverfront development and a site for the Great American Ballpark. I conceived that site, and one of my best friends had an alternative site at the edge of over the Rhine, It actually went to the ballot. He chaired that, the Broadway Commons site. I chaired the Riverfront site. We won by 2-1.
And that would have been a kind of a neighborhood site.
That was a neighborhood site. Our argument was not really about the ballpark. Our argument was about the infrastructure that accompanies the ballpark. Our river out here floods. It varies in its height by, you know, some years 30 feet, often by 10 or 15. We needed to, in order to build down there, we needed to elevate the buildings on garages. So when we were able to shrink the highway, we filled that land with what's going to become one of the largest parking garages in North America, which solved forever our downtown parking problem, but also provide a platform for about $2 billion worth of development. So that's getting close to being finished now. And then I got interested in the rail through Downtown Cincinnati, Inc., and the streetcar kind of, you know, came from that. But I just think I tend to look at things at city scale, that infrastructure is really driven by the engineers who are given a problem to solve and then figure out how to reduce the cost and make it the most efficient. I'm trained as an economist where you tend to look at all the options, and so I tend to come up with sort of ideas out of the blue that they haven't considered.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of times the engineers are not, they kind of get blamed for things, right? They actually draw up the bridges or they draw up the interchanges and things like that, and I think a lot of times they're answering the wrong question, right? So they do a great job designing what they were told to design.
Exactly.
And innovative solutions and maybe cost-saving solutions, but a lot of times these are, I always say traffic and interstates are, these are political and social questions, not engineering problems. I mean,
exactly,
engineers can
yeah.
build what we want, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, good case with Fort Washington Way. That project opened in about 1960. Like most freeways that went through cities opened about that time. The state was going to just rebuild it with its sloppy construction, just the way it, not sloppy. It was sloppy because over the years so many entrances and exits got added to it that it just didn't work anymore. But they were just going to rebuild it. So I was chairman of the DCI Transportation Committee, and somebody sent me a letter from the city asking me to approve the maintenance of traffic plan. And I wrote back and I said, you know, as long as you ask, we'd like to just totally look at that entire freeway system from the get-go. And it was just enough to get our foot in the door. And it was just enough to intrigue some of the corporate leaders of our city to say, you know, we actually ought to look at that because, you know, it's kind of cut us off from the riverfront. That was just dumb luck. And, and as it turned out, the state got, you know, they got behind it and made it happen.
So you have the downtown interstate, the ballpark. And then, again, you mentioned to me earlier that you took a trip to St. Louis, met Tom Schrout, who is the executive director of Citizens for Modern Transit for a very long time and is now living in all places of Los Angeles.
In high rise.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, loving
we're friends on Facebook. I see what he's up to.
But I think he's ditched the car, or if not, he's parked it somewhere for a while. So he's loving it out there. But tell us about that experience. And you were there when Metrolink opened, basically. And you described yourself as a skeptic of light rail before you went.
I had been a longtime bus rider. And, you know, I happened to live on a bus line where the buses came every 10 minutes. I never had a schedule. I mean, they just were so frequent. And Tom came to Cincinnati when we were looking at light rail because St. Louis had been successful. And after one of the meetings, I said, you know, give me a card. I might want to come out there sometime because I was skeptical. So I went out and spent most of a day out there. I mean, got there early in the morning and got a late night flight back. And Tom showed me all around. And he really kind of, you know, opened my eyes to, you know, what were the potentials here. And I remember talking to a young woman in a rail yard with her kids. And, you know, she told me exactly why the Metrolink worked for her and the buses didn't. So I came back with the feeling that, you know, there's a human story to this, too. It's not just all about engineering. It's really how does this help people take care of their families and get them to work and earn more money and all that kind of stuff and to redevelop neighborhoods. So I just sort of fell into it.
That's great. And in St. Louis, for a long time, there wasn't a real message behind, you know, rail expansion and transit expansion. And they hit on the last campaign that was successful was a tax increase several years ago, kind of at the height of the recession, was on this point that people use it to get to work. They use it, you know, with their kids. It was a human story. And that's what kind of carried the day. And that was a referendum that passed to just increase, you know, funding for our local transit system. And so it's a good thing not to forget. Well, let's move forward. We'll wrap it up in a few minutes. But what's happening next with the line here? Not to get ahead of ourselves. It hasn't opened for use yet, right? So all the training is happening and the certification is happening. But there were originally plans to take this up the hill, basically, to University of Cincinnati. There's been talk now of taking it across the Ohio River into Kentucky. What's next for the streetcar in Cincinnati?
Well, we'll deal with Kentucky first. I talked to them last week, and they have apparently some support from Mitch McConnell, obviously a very important person in Washington.
The senior senator, I believe.
Yeah, to get them some funding to do a feasibility study. I walk their line, and actually their economic development potential, I think, per mile, if you want to look at it, far exceeds Cincinnati's. So I think that has legs.
Now, where does that go in Kentucky? Because on the Ohio side, so the Ohio River, lucky for you guys, is about half the width of the Mississippi, and you have some geography on the other side where there are small towns and hills and things like that. So there's real development potential on the other side of your river,
right,
in Newport and Covington specifically. But where does that line go? Who's
that line would? There are two cities opposite Cincinnati, Newport and Covington, and you know they are. Probably each, they're certainly top 10 cities in Kentucky. Covington might be a top 5 city. They're good size. The line that's being talked about now would go out through the Eastern River from the Cincinnati to Newport, and then would turn and head towards Covington. They would have to build a new bridge across the river that's between those two cities. But they seem very purposeful, and of course, you know, they don't have to go to Portland, Oregon, 2,000 miles away to look at a streetcar now like we did. They can just, you know, get in their cars and drive 5 minutes. So that's going to happen. The Governor Kasich, who was a candidate for president, and has been a decent governor for, is very popular in Ohio, right after he was elected, he canceled a $52 million grant that had been awarded by the state to extend the streetcar to the University of Cincinnati, which is Ohio's second largest university.
And they basically moved the goalpost, right? They changed the scoring of transportation projects or something like that, and ended up giving the money to...
Under Governor Strickland, who's now running for the Senate, it had, under the scoring system, it had been by far the highest scoring project in the state. I mean, just blew the doors off the scoring system. They threw that system out and just sort of said, we think there's a freeway exit, you know, in Akron that we use that
and
money.
And this is how this is a political issue. I mean, there's no definitive, like, a streetcar is better than a highway interchange. These are social questions and political questions.
Right, and he was never a supporter. So we're gonna. I'm guessing that in the 2017 city council and mayor elections, we're gonna make the streetcar issue again. Except this is gonna be about extending it to the University of Cincinnati. I believe it's going to take a tunnel, actually 2 half-mile-long tunnels with a stop in between that's above grade. And, you know, we're a very hilly city, and the advantage of that would be it'd be faster than driving. And that's where transit really works, when it's faster than driving. That's why it works in London and Paris and New York and all the principal cities of the world. Typically, light rail or streetcars are not faster, but in this case, we believe it would be. So I've had some engineers looking at that, and it's definitely a doable proposition. It's expensive, but at some point you're going to look at the time it's going to save people, and you're going to factor that in as a benefit.
And these aren't cut and cover tunnels. These are serious hills.
They'd be drilled tunnels. At one point it would be 100 feet underground. The soil conditions are ideal from the information that we've been able to gather. So that'll happen. And you know, then it starts to get really interesting. Once we've connected downtown, which is the largest employment center in the region, with the University of Cincinnati and its hospitals, which is very much like St. Louis if you go from downtown to the west, and the spacing is kind of similar. I mean,
We almost have two UCs. It would be like connecting. It's like having UC and Xavier right in a line.
Right. Well, that's Xavier's. You know, 2 miles from UC. So, the vision I'm trying to say is, let's do a spine line that goes between downtown and UC, and then on to Xavier, and then at Xavier there are three mainline railroads that. Abandoned railroads that come together on their campus. They've actually preserved those right-of-ways through their campus. So Xavier, which is a little out of the swim of things here in our city these days, it's, you know, 5 miles from the city center, all of a sudden it would be a place where all these rail lines come together. So we'll see. But what I'm telling people is that we should design the line between downtown and UC for multiple routes, a non-compromised, you know, line. Needs to be, you know, very, very usable.
So I like how you say that's going to happen. I love that kind of force of nature of like, so that's going to happen. So we're just going to build in Kentucky. Well, we're going to build here. But this is an idea that is relatively new, right? So there's a line mapped out that would go up Fine Street, which is
terrible route.
Hill, and
the best thing Governor Kasich ever did for our project was cancel that. Actually, I really believe that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if
I
gave him the satisfaction
to be said
of telling that.
Creativity and money, and I think sometimes in St. Louis we come up with a big idea and there's a huge pile of money, hundreds of millions of dollars, and we just do it, and that doesn't force any kind of creativity or rethinking, or you know, a lot of these big projects don't happen. The best idea isn't conceived at one time and built over 10 years. These things do have to adjust and be modified and adjusted to fit the current situation.
Well, I think what's going to happen is, first of all, like Kansas City, we bought, for our streetcar, we actually bought light rail cars. So I'm going to tell people when this is up and running, hey, do you like that? You know, we could put more seats in that and gear it differently. And that could go all the way to the county line.
They can go more than 20 miles an hour.
Right. And I think, I've seen this movie before, and I know how it works with intense skepticism, often tremendous opposition. And then the line opens, and people say, we had no idea, you know, and I've seen that on the streets down here when the streetcars are out and people see it for the first time. So
that's what's amazing is like no one's even used it here, and still it's already its best advertisement.
And, you know, I mean, we're looking at this beer here. There's probably a streetcar Ryan Geist beer here at some point, but it'll happen. I think that you know we are. St. Louis has always been a rail town, right? I mean, you're like Chicago. I mean, we bet on steamboats.
Mm-hmm.
We lost that bet, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So there's never been the culture of rail here, and as a result, I think people just have to get a taste of it, and they're going to like the taste. It's going to be really great.
And so when does it open? What's
it
the
opens
timeline
at 10:30
like?
On September 9th.
Okay.
I think we're going to have a huge a crowd. I think we're going to. I've talked to people. The mayor of Portland is bringing his wife. The recently retired longtime director of Portland Streetcars, he's coming out. I would think we're going to have, it's going to be a great event. And, you know, all the businesses along the line are working out promotions for that weekend. And the great thing is we're going to open on September 9th, and then the next weekend is Oktoberfest, which is the second largest Oktoberfest in the world behind Munich. So we're going to get an opportunity in the month of September when the weather is virtually perfect. For all you people listening in St. Louis, it's virtually perfect here in September. We're going to have a great time to show off the streetcar in this first month.
That's great. Well, I appreciate you taking time to talk to us about
great.
It, and it couldn't be a better setting. And, you know, we're excited to see the streetcar come and hopefully get our own kind of modern streetcar project off the ground in St. Louis. So thanks a lot.
Well, John. You know, they should come to Cincinnati or Kansas City. I think those are the two cities really to see kind of how it's done.
That sounds great. Thanks again.
Thanks, Alex.
Thank you to Creatives on Call for sponsoring the Future Great City podcast. Creatives on Call is a staffing agency dedicated to matching creatives with temporary, freelance, and permanent positions in the design and marketing industries. Visit creativesoncall.com. And thank you again to Red Brick Realty, the new full-service boutique St. Louis brokerage firm. Give Scott a call at 314-420-9491 and get $500 off by mentioning the Future Great City podcast when you close a deal with Red Brick.
You can subscribe to this podcast via RSS feed or on iTunes, and can follow the site on Twitter at NextSTL. Thanks for joining us. Be informed, be engaged, be part of what's next. NextSTL.com.